Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. To learn more about Allowed and how you can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The program you're about to hear from the Allowed Archives was produced in 2007. Dave Eggers pegged it when he wrote that Edmund White is one of three or four most virtuosic living writers of sentences in the English language. Mr. White's novels include Fanny, A Fiction, A Boy's Own Story, The Farewell Symphony, and A Married Man. He is also the author of a number of works of nonfiction, including his memoir, My Lives, A Study of Marcel Proust, and the definitive biography of Jean Genet, for which he was awarded the 1993 National Book Critics Circle Award for Biography. He lived for many years in Paris and is the author of The Flaneur, A Stroll Through the Paradoxes of Paris, which I advise you to read before your next trip to Paris, or even if you're not going to Paris, in lieu of a trip to Paris. It's a wonderful book. In Stephen Barber's book, Edmund White, The Burning World, he writes, "White's work explores what it is to experience a life fully. His work has dealt with everything from the minutely nuanced moods of gay childhood to the sudden desolation resulting from AIDS. White's writings look forward to a future of culture as one unlimited by either the rigidity of political correctness or the persecution of individuals for their race or sexuality. In large part, his experiences as an outsider in Paris and his contacts with other expatriate writers and artists there gave to White his view of the future of culture as hybrid and proliferating, impossible to pin down to a national or political or social formula, and finally, joyfully elusive." The most recent novel by Edmund White, who currently teaches at Princeton, is Hotel de Dream, a New York novel. In this feat of subtly layered storytelling, White interweaves historical truth and literary fabrication as he imagines the last days of novelist Stephen Crane and the novel he dictates on his deathbed about a young, uneducated country boy who comes to New York City and becomes a hustler. This is one American master turning to another. In conversation with Edmund White tonight is Michael Silverblatt, known to most of you, I'm sure, as the erudite and genial host of KCRW's The Bookworm, a show he created for KCRW in 1989, and which is now considered one of the country's premier literary talk shows. So please, we will all turn off our cell phones and pagers. Please welcome Michael Silverblatt and Edmund White to the Los Angeles Public Library.
We're going to range widely across Edmund White's career, not just the new book, but we will start with that new book. Now, I first met Edmund White, met him, as opposed to interview him, at the home of Joyce Carol Oates, where he revealed himself, to my mind, to be perhaps the world's most courtly and effervescent, limber, impressive, dexterous dinner guest. And he credits in the acknowledgments of this book, which is Hotel de Dream, he credits Joyce Carol Oates with the role of muse, my muse, Joyce Carol Oates. And I wanted to ask you to tell me about that. What does a muse do? And have you had previous muses?
I have had previous muses. Mrs. Nabokov, Nabokov's wife, Vera, was a sort of muse of mine. She had the extraordinary ability to remember. She had an eidetic memory. So when I first met her, she recited to me a whole page from my first novel, Forgetting Elena, without consulting any notes. And, of course, that's probably the most flattering thing you can do to any writer. We should all develop those skills if we want to seduce them. So I was completely seduced by her. And anyway, I used to always think about her because I thought it's important not to just use lots of brand names and refer to all kinds of in-jokes. That you don't want to preach to the converted. You want to speak to somebody who knows English perfectly, the way Vera Nabokov did, but that doesn't live here currently and doesn't, wouldn't know those references. And so that's a way of screening out too much of the topical so that your work might have a chance of being understood 20 years from now or in another country. So anyway, so that was one muse. And of course, she had been a muse to the greatest writer of the 20th century. And then Joyce Carol Oates, her office is right across the hall from mine, and we endlessly are bopping back and forth to see each other. And she's an adorable, very funny, very sweet, very generous person. I don't think the humor comes through really in her writing, but in real life, she's terribly funny. And anyway, she's so charming and nice. And she was really the one who got me to come to Princeton. And the minute I came, she began to take me out. Because people imagine that if anybody writes as much as Joyce Carol Oates, that she couldn't have a social life. Well, far from it. She has a total, huge social life. Every night she goes out. And she writes reviews for the New York Review of Books. And she's a full-time teacher. And she directs people's theses. And she has endless energy. But anyway, so in that way, just in her general warmth and acceptance, she was a muse. But more importantly, I think, because I feel like she really understands my writing, and I'm always eager to see what she'll say about it.
Because, you know, when I first read Edmund White, I began reading him with his second book, Nocturnes for the King of Naples. It was preceded by a book called Forgetting Elena, which was a book Nabokov had praised. And these were very aesthetically based novels. I won't say that this is the opposite of what Edmund White does now, because I regard him as someone who arrived gifted with an extraordinary dexterity in prose style, and that is still there. But you've become interested, especially in this book, in questions of realism, of naturalism, of knowing the underside of a city. In fact, immediately in competition with your aesthetic novels was The Joy of Gay Sex, so that there was always a world in which the world appeared and then the dream world. But I think of Joyce Carol Oates as being America's leading realist or naturalist writer. And she works in that way. And it seems to some extent that you've been exploring realism more deeply since your encounters with her.
That could well be. I mean, one isn't always aware of the influences. I think I always had an interest in research and history. And I think when I wrote the biography of Jean Genet, which took me 7 years to research, I got terribly interested in being a kind of a library rat and reading things and consulting things. And I always felt like I was a sort of scholar monkey. And so that satisfied, that kind of awakened that urge, I suppose. And then I've written other nonfiction books where I had to do a lot of research. And then with Fanny, I wrote my first historical novel. And I had a year off from Princeton, and I spent the whole year in the British Library researching that book and writing it. And Joyce Carol Oates, for instance, to give her credit again, I said to her, well, when you're writing a historical novel, should you do all the research and then write it? And she says, oh, no, start writing it right away and do your research as you go along, or otherwise you'll forget it all. And she knows me all too well. I would forget it. It would just be complete tabula rasa within a few days later. So I had a wonderful time working on that book. And then with this book, again, I was in a library because I got a fellowship to the 42nd Street Library in New York at the Cullman Center, and they give you a small office and a small salary and a rather large computer and access to 7 million books and 40 librarians. So that, for instance, in this book, there's a moment when a kind of mediocre sculptor does a life-size statue of a nude boy. And I asked this one librarian to help me research. I said, what would a mediocre sculptor of 1892 have been paid for that? You know, so he goes into the Stonecutter and Mason's journal. And then what helped him the most in finding this was the prices in auctioneers' catalogs around that time. And I was able to get an exact sum for that. And almost everything, like at the library, the 42nd Street Library, they have this incredible visual library that's right there on the computer. So that, for instance, when I read that this Stephen Crane in real life took this boy that he based the boy prostitute character on to dinner at the Everett House. So you look up Everett House, you find out it was quite a swanky hotel on Union Square in New York. And then you type some more and you can get all the menus, because they have all the menus from the 1890s in that particular restaurant. So you can know exactly what they were eating, you know. So when it says the joint was passed at 5, it wasn't marijuana. It was this big silver cart with the roast on it. And it was terribly interesting to get all this information. And oftentimes the information would inspire me in ways that I think no act of imagination could have. I mean, I feel like facts are more interesting than what you dream up. So that, for instance, when I had this kind of daydream one day on my couch, and I thought, oh, I know this man, this older man, this banker who's in love with this boy, will have a life-size statue of him made so that he can put it in his living room in front of his wife and children, and it'll just look like what a banker should have, a work of neoclassical art. But it'll be his boyfriend down to the smallest mole. And so I thought, but who should sculpt it? And then I thought, well, who did the lions in front of the 42nd Street Library? I looked that up, Picciarelli, Attilio Picciarelli. So then I look up at all the Picciarellis, and it turns out that American sculptors didn't know how to really sculpt in marble properly, that when they would do these huge things like the Lincoln and the Lincoln Memorial, they'd have to send a little maquette to Europe, and then good stoneworkers in Europe would render it into this gigantic thing and send it back at enormous expense on a boat. Well, the Picciarellis thought, well, we'll short-circuit that. Because they were all from Carrara, where the marble's from, and they had learned how, there were five brothers. So they set up a shop in the Bronx. And so I thought, all right, I'll have the Picciarellis do this statue. And then I found out what prices they would have been paid. And then I thought, well, it would help me an awful lot if maybe Mr. Picciarelli was gay or just a little bit gay. So I start reading these big, thick biographies. And it turns out he was. I mean, that is, he was living with the Italian ambassador to America right at the outbreak of World War I. And this ambassador was endlessly being arrested for molesting boys. So I thought, wow, that's interesting. I mean, he married very late, a very sedate lady. But up to that point, he seems to have been mostly hanging out with this ambassador. But anyway, it's just so funny how things fall into your hands, maybe if your hands are especially greedy.
Now, that boy, that sculptor, the actuality of the life is in contrast in this novel to the kind of interiorizing life and mind of Henry James, who is, in a sense, this novel's villain. If there is one, he's a very destructive figure in this book. And I thought, just so that you'll get an idea of the feel of this, I'd ask you to read the Henry James introduction section of Hotel de Dream.
Yeah, with pleasure. Oh, of course, I thought I'd marked the page, but no, I can't find it. Oh, there it is. Oh, so Stephen Crane and his common-law wife, I mean, he would have married her properly if they could have found her a second husband to arrange for a divorce, but they could never find him. So, and she's a kind of wonderful, I think, wonderful woman who was a bit older than Crane, and she was she had a whorehouse in Jacksonville, Florida, called Hotel de Dream. So that's where I got my title. But they had decided to move to the south of England, to Sussex, and they rented an enormous Gothic pile called Brede Place, which was quite near where Henry James lived, and a lot of other literary folks were in that neighborhood, like Ford Madox Ford, like Joseph Conrad. And Conrad also makes a little cameo appearance in my book. And so anyway, that's the setting. Henry James had come to visit. He'd sent a note first, and Cora had torn it open and skimmed it as she rushed to do something else, and then she had had to sit down and parse it. Chers enfants, since I will be in the vicinity of Brede for reasons I will not deprive you the pleasure of divining, I will, quote, drop by, unquote, toward tea time in response to your extremely kind, quote, open invitation, the openness of which can constitute an ambiguous ouverture d'esprit one sometimes cowers before. A bientôt, your oncle d'Amérique, in lavished affection, if not, in fact, in wealth. She found the grammar hard to diagram mentally, and the quotation marks embracing ordinary words somewhat ominous. Tea time, good heavens, he'd be here in a moment. Why did he write such beardless sentences? She found Lucy, that's the maid, in the blackened medieval kitchen holding dishes under the trickle of sink water and humming fiercely. Do we have any cake to serve, Mr. James? Cora asked. Lord, madam, is that old woman coming to bother us again with his hemming and hawing? Cora started giggling. Can you help me put my hair up? I've been airing it only half an hour, but Mr. James will be shocked to see it down. She has this idea that she should air her hair because she read that Sarah Bernhardt did that, and that's why it looked so young, so late. But one time Arnold Bennett came to visit, and he saw her with her hair down, and he wrote in his journal, it was awful, it was ghastly. It was like having breakfast with an actress. Lucy dried her cold red hands on her dirty apron and accompanied Cora to her dressing table, the one that sat at an angle on its spindly legs and caught only a glimmer of cold blue light in its tarnished mirror. Once Lucy's hands warmed up, they went about their work with agility. When she rose from doing her beauté, Cora looked out the oriel window and spied Mr. James on his bicycle approaching the house. Oh, God, she mumbled, as she almost simultaneously clapped a smile to her lips. She hurried to the great oak door just as Mr. James was removing the bicycle clips from his trousers and straightening the plaid leg. He lifted his soft brown hat as if in greeting, but it was only to pass a large white handkerchief over his shiny skull. He tilted his head to one side in response to Cora's high bird calls of greeting. A bright, droll smile cracked open the tragic mask of his face. A sort of rumbling of language began in his feet and shivered up his legs, shook his torso, and finally spilled from his throat in a high nasal stammer. There was, and undoubtedly still is, a mist on the hills that I find, And here he paused and stuttered as he sought the mot juste, his eyes wandering as if the word itself were a butterfly drifting from the small-leaved boxwood bush into the smoky vastness of the hall. That I find picturesque? Cora asked brightly. But Mr. James instantly pushed the offensive banality aside and at last spat out, damn picturesque! The words so painfully chosen plunged him into an iridescent play of irony and pleasure, which swirled over his features and ended in a firm thrusting forward of his shaved jaw. As Cora followed him upstairs to Stevie's studio, the great man stopped suddenly and nearly knocked her over. He stood there one step above her and asked her minutely detailed questions about arrangements for Stevie's care and her plans to take him to Germany and the Black Forest and a TB clinic. His questions implied she needed supervision. At every point, he would start his infernal rumbling in search of the right word, as if he were an espresso pot, a purely egotistical exercise, she thought, since she dared say he had no respect for her opinion. In any event, she was always quite happy with the slipshod approximations of ordinary human conversation. Nor did he like her. She knew that James had reportedly told someone after she first met him that she was a Byrock-side blonde, considerably older than her husband, with a dull, common manner and a past. And he'd claimed that initially he'd taken her to be a servant. Come to think of it, maybe it was Richard Harding Davis who'd made that crack about her hair color. The minute he saw Stevie on his daybed, Mr. James lit up and trundled his solid, portly body to his side, though typically he couldn't summon up the usual effusions. Rather, he looked back at her, and then again at Stevie, and at last he said, with a strangely episcopal opening of his hands, palms up, "And here is Cora, and here is Stevie." Then, because he could never say anything just once, he added, "And here is Stevie." And he settled on the straw-seated wood chair with an abruptness that made her fear he'd crash through the bottom. Stevie seemed happy, though he'd just awakened from a deep, feverish sleep. As though to distract his visitor from his own disorientation, he has TB and he's going to be dead in 2 weeks, he's only 28 years old. As though to distract his visitor from his own disorientation, he asked in a boy's clear voice, "Tell me, why do you live here?" Mr. James appeared startled. He, who usually barraged his friends with questions, but was of such an extreme discretion that he almost never submitted to their interrogations, which in any case were invariably fruitless. But now he said, "Here, in Sussex?" Stevie nodded. James said, "I like golfers. I like seeing them strolling about in their plus fours." He and Stevie laughed at the silliness of it all. "If you mean in England," the older man continued, "I've always been half English since I spent so much of my boyhood reading Punch. But if I'm half English, I'm also half French, since when I'm in a rush, I jot notes to myself in French." He ended his remarks with an odd drum roll of his hand on the side table. Nothing this man came up with, Cora thought, was foreseeable, neither his words nor his deeds. At her place of business in Florida, the Hotel de Dream, she'd never entertained his sort. Not the sort of individual we'd get, she thought dismissively. She could tell by the way that James lit up around her husband that he was queer as a football bat. At first she thought it was just due to how English and prissy he'd become, but her friend, the late, dear, disabused Harold Frederick, another transplanted American writer, had set her straight. "Oh, he's all woman, and he wants everyone to treat him like a pope, or the Queen Henrietta Maria." But Mr. James never gave in to his impulses. He wouldn't hug or kiss the poor, thin, sweating Stevie. No, he would study him and prod him, then slather him with praise in a sentence that might end with a sting in his tail. "Mr. James," she said, "did you know I've invented a canteen filter?" The great man looked at her wild-eyed. He liked to be prepared for any turn the talk might take, but she left him nonplussed once again. What? "Well, when we were covering the war in Greece, I realized how hard it was for soldiers to find pure water, water that wouldn't give them dysentery. You know, poor Stevie was crippled with it. He barely got off the pot 15 minutes to actually witness the wretched war. And so I've come up with an invention. It's going to make my fortune. It's a filter fixed right inside the canteen that removes all impurities. It only needs to be cleaned once a week. Would you like to see the maquette I've had fabricated? I'm collaborating with an engineer, Mr. Frederick Bowen. I'd never be able to go it alone. He's made three models, and he's separated mud from water. He says he's uncovered important facts about metallic and carbon content." Henry James' face registered his growing horror at everything she was conjuring up. Leaking bowels, money, mud, war, and the unspeakable manufactured item itself. His mouth twitched and his eyes tightened in small spasms, as if unheard explosions were being detonated far inside the cavern of his mammoth head. At last, recognizing that she'd become an immense and immovable detour, he lifted his hands above his head. He appeared to be warding off a downpour of pebbles. Cora liked shocking him. She saw that he didn't know what to make of her bright, breezy manner. Maybe he found her filter to be irrelevant to the grand deathbed scene with Stevie he was preparing. A fife to the full orchestra that was raising its hushed, murmuring chorus. She didn't give a damn. She needed to live, to survive. And what means did she have beyond the filter and the pages Stevie kept grinding out? The money would go into the trip to Germany she was planning. She needed every penny for the journey. She said to James, whose upraised hands were only now very slowly wilting back to his lap, "What about it? Want to see the filter?" "I can't," Mr. James said, "extract everything I need to from what you just uttered. But if I scurry off with it like some great nut in my pouch, you can be sure that later when I'm alone, I will extract something to your advantage." Oh, it's all very simple, Cora said to this man, whose feelings, she was sure, were as undiluted as hers, but whose thoughts were so infernally dirty and roiled. I'm going to need money, lots of it, when we take the train to Dover on May 7th. Oh, that's just next week, come to think of it, and make our way to the continent. We'll need our own railway carriage and a doctor and a nurse or two to travel with us. Mr. James blinked rhythmically under the successive blows of Cora's words. She knew he hated the red, stinging hand of fact slapping him back and forth in the face. We'll stop in Dover for a few days until Stevie has all his energy back. We'll stay at the Lord Warden Hotel, which Mr. Conrad tells me is just off the Admiralty Pier, where seamen depart for Calais, where steamers depart for Calais and Austin three times a day. Of course, we'll take our dog, Spongy, too, but I'd wager the whole shebang will cost up to £100, everything rounded off to the nearest zero. Mr. James's sensitive, stony face had been willed into impassivity, but it still flinched under the rapid blows of Spongy, shebang, and nearest zero. In an orthographical aside to himself, he wondered if it were spelled C-H-E-B-A-N-G. He'd seen it written like that once in Mark Twain. Suddenly he remembered something and brought out of his pocket a dog-eared copy of a magazine. I have a story in here, Mr. James said, fixing Stevie with a scowl. I've dedicated it to you. I think, and here he broke off for rhetorical effect, I think it will be of special interest to you. Cora didn't mind it when other men mashed on Stevie, nor other women. She knew he was famous and young and so sweet and sincere that he was irresistible. His fame worked into the equation because it constituted something like a bold-printed finger stamped in red in the margin to draw the reader's attention to a remarkable, if quiet, passage. Stevie was soft-spoken and frail and really insignificant physically, except for his eyes, the irises the color of wet sand, their soulfulness enhanced by his flowing mustaches and an oddly romantic reciprocity she'd noticed in other young men. Stevie went to some pains to shave that little groove between the septum of his nose and the top of his upper lip. The philtrum, it was called. Stevie had taught her that, he who loves strange words. She didn't mind that other people admired her little husband and even lusted after him. In her work at the Hotel de Dream, she'd observed the hydraulics of desire so often that she didn't take pleasure too seriously. Some men could mistake lust for love, but she felt that Stevie, in any case, wouldn't lust after this pudgy, bald man, though he loved Mr. James's conversation. She could smell James's lemony eau de cologne now that his body was heating up as he rumbled along in conversation. She left the men and went to her own room to work on the text for her next article.
Would you say, if you had to, that that the Henry James style is virtually the opposite of the Stephen Crane style?
Yes. Yes, I mean, I think so, definitely. And I mean, Crane really invented a very modern style, which reminds us when we read it of Hemingway. And it's hard to imagine that this was written in the 1890s. I mean, Red Badge, of course, a lot of people think he lived through the Civil War, and that's why he wrote Red Badge Courage, but he was born after the Civil War was over. And I think what really influenced him was Tolstoy's battle reports of Sebastopol, because they're very clean and very quirky and full of strange details, and they show the whole horror of war rather than the glory of it, which was not typical for the 19th century. So I think Crane admittedly was very influenced by that. And the other thing was, one day he was at a friend's house, and he picked up a magazine that was full of first-person testimonials by Civil War veterans, and he sort of skimmed it for all the details. And he was a very quick study. He never read a book to the end, and he didn't care about literature. I mean, Camus once said that American writers are the only writers in the world who aren't also intellectuals. And certainly that was true of Crane, and he sort of invented that. And then later writers like Fitzgerald and Hemingway developed that theme in American literature.
Because when I was reading the book, you know, I thought, oh no, Edmund White doesn't like Henry James. How, you know, I've been sort of schooled in the devotion of Henry James. You know, you'd better, in a sense, like James, and even in a way John Ashbery talks about in one of his essays, James's way of making a sentence claustrophobic and painful. And Ashbery suggests that this is the virtue of James, that he invented a new refinement of the torture of literature.
Well, I remember once I was reading The Golden Bowl, and I was living in Rome in those days, and I got to the line, "Her hair was what was vulgarly called brown." And I threw the book. I said, "Fuck you." You know, I just was so irritated with him. But no, I revere him the way we all do. And I actually read him a lot. And I think some things like The Turn of the Screw are among the best things in English. I mean, I think he could be a very great writer. And he could also be a terribly irritating one. But it's interesting that two of the greatest writers, both gay, Proust and James, both had such a weird manner that they're almost fatal influences on other writers. Unfortunately, in France, there are an awful lot of writers who try to write like Proust, and it's always a disaster. And in English, James has certainly had a big influence, though now it's lessening, I'm happy to say. But I think that he in himself is totally admirable, of course.
Because when I'm trying to figure you out, which sometimes happens, I think to myself, you know, the most extreme stylizations come in novelists who are known to be or thought to be gay. That's Proust, Genet, Ronald Fairbank, even in his own way, Dennis Cooper. Extremist stylizations. When you think even in poetry, just of our own Whitman.
John Ashbery.
The stylized is at the center. And I've always felt that you were in an arm wrestle to bring something else in, that after those first two novels plus Caracol, see, I told you I'd be referring to the whole career, and I'm not breaking my promise. After those first two novels with Caracol added, there's an attempt to say, I want to be a gay writer, I want to tell a gay truth, and I want to do it outside of the excessive aestheticism that has been assigned to
gay
writing.
It's only in the rarefied world of your mind that that would seem to be true, because because an awful lot, I mean, I'll tell you, the average gay reader complains about my gay novels being too difficult, too many big words, too arty. I mean, it's not as though I'm really rocking and rolling with these books. Do you know, I mean, they're still quite over the top for most readers in terms of refinement and indirection. But no, I know what you mean. And I think it's true that for, at least in terms of my career, I did make a break away from, I mean, when I first started writing in the 60s, the avant-garde was still supreme. I mean, there were still all these writers, the metafiction writers, and I even contemplated writing a book about all of them, you know, John Barth and Barthelme and Coover and all these people. Thank God I was spared that. I mean, nobody was interested in the idea, and I didn't have to write that book or be ashamed of it in my oeuvre. But in any event, I mean, I was very interested in that world. And Kafka certainly was a tremendous, and Beckett, those were all big influences. And that was the world we lived in, people who were serious about literature in the late 60s, early 70s. But then by the time I had sort of broken through the ice by writing The Joy of Gay Sex and dealing with the scoffing of all my literary friends, and which I did because I was raising my nephew, and I was always going to say, if I was invited on some talk show, why did you write The Joy of Gay Sex? I'd say, to raise my son, you know, my nephew. I mean, I raised my nephew because I needed money to do that. Anyway, so having written that, then I wrote a book called States of Desire, Travels in Gay America. And then I thought, well, now I've written about all these people living across America in a very superficial way, but still, and different kinds of gay people. And then I thought, now I'd like to do an in-depth study of one gay person. And I thought, well, whom do I know better than myself? So I thought I will do this trilogy, and I started with The Boy's Own Story, then it went on to Beautiful Room is Empty and The Farewell Symphony. And then history sort of conspired to amplify the book in a way, because what I couldn't have foreseen when I began was AIDS. I mean, the first one was published in 82, and AIDS had just begun in 81, but we had no idea of the dimensions it would take in our lives. So by the time I got to the final one, I was able to write hundreds of pages about the AIDS epidemic. So I was so fascinated by the subject matter, which seemed to me so new and still at that point so unwritten about, that it was a great thrill to write about it in the most direct way that I could think of.
Well, it was, I think, a very courageous thing, because you had essentially said, and this was something that came up really in New York conversation. I'm asking you all to imagine a world in which such things do come up in conversation. That's the world I was born into and the world you came to when you came to New York. And Susan Sontag said to me, we were in her kitchen, Edmund White is taking the position that at this time it is more important to tell the story of the people who are dealing with AIDS than to make literature. And, you know, this was quite a shocking thing for people who were still deciding what side of the fence are they going to stay on, the side of art or the horrible facts of life that were emerging. And, of course, typically of New York, no one thought you could do both, you know, be artistic and be truthful. Never. And so I think it was a truly radical moment, because you were also approaching a different kind of reader with the books. We have lived through a tragedy that knows no words, that we have to find words for. I will help you.
Well, it was also help myself. I mean, I was diagnosed as HIV positive in 1985. I had already been living 3 years in France at that point. I went on living another 12. The way I came out or discovered that I was HIV positive was absolutely appalling, because in those days I went to Zurich and a doctor took my blood and then had to be sent off to America. You had to wait for 6 weeks for it to come back. And then I was summoned again to Zurich because they wouldn't tell you over the phone. And this very elegant, heterosexual young doctor sort of extended this beautifully polished shoe toward me and said, well, yeah, you're positive. And that was it. I mean, no counseling, no nothing. And so, you know, and then the French don't like communitarian life, and they don't organize very much except in the old-fashioned political way. But it's very unusual to have things like consciousness-raising groups or even AA or anything like that. They don't like that. And so I was one of the founding members of Gay Men's Health Crisis in New York, and then of AIDS, AIDES, which was the French version of that. But even so, nobody was there to talk to, nobody to share with. So suddenly I got very interested in writing for gay readers who were going through the same thing. I thought, I want to share all this with somebody else. I want to touch somebody who could help me too, and I could help them. And I felt like I had been one of the first people who had come out as a gay person and written about it. So I thought, now here's another hurdle to come out as a person who's positive. Well, I didn't realize there were really many more repercussions to coming out as somebody positive than there were to coming out as a gay person. I mean, it was much more, it made me much more into a pariah socially and sexually than I thought it would. Now people are very sophisticated and they understand it all, and everything's changed. But at the time, you know, this was still a time when people didn't want to shake your hand if they thought you were positive. And so anyway, I went through a lot with that. And so the writing was really coming out of a very, I hate to maybe sound too Oprah-like about all this, but it was coming out of a very personal and lived experience. It wasn't just my deciding to help others, you know.
But you see, it was very interesting because at around the same time, Dorothy Allison, who was running women's writing groups in San Francisco, said to me, you know, I think the time of telling everyone has a story, true, but it's time for people to decide who is a writer and who isn't. For 10 years now, I've been encouraging people to tell their stories, and people are now pretty familiar with telling their stories. Now, let's learn how to write. And it's been very interesting to watch a gay community forming that is interested in creating a literature again. And that, again, you've been instrumental in that as well, because by the time you wrote the Farewell Symphony and
The Married Man?
The Married Man, it was taking the difficult, the impossible truths that you had been telling and now seeing could they be given a form, could they enter a structure. And while...
It was interesting for me that, I mean, just to mention one thing, that I when I wrote the biography of Jean Genet, which was 700 pages long or something, I realized that if you have a character with a name, Genet, and you follow him from birth to death, that you can pin onto this one person all kinds of innumerable facts that you, as a novelist, would never have imagined could go together. I mean, Genet began as a peasant in the most bigoted rural milieu imaginable and ended up as a friend of the Black Panthers and the Palestinians. That was quite a trajectory. No way to foresee it. And there's no way to reduce him, to apply any kind of Freudian reductionism to him. There was no trauma. And what's interesting is that this extraordinary man who had this very widely reaching and branching life, I thought, well, that gives me a clue even as a novelist, because I knew that in the Farewell Symphony I wanted to write about both the 70s and the 80s, that is, both the golden age of promiscuity and then the dreadful period of AIDS. And I thought, it's too much information. There's no way to put it all inside this skein of the novel. But I thought, what the hell? I'll try to push the idea of form to its extreme limits and just have it all happen to one person the way Genet's life happened to one person. So it was really biography that gave me the clue of this kind of new, much more free-form version of the novel.
Now, to go full circle, to come back to Hotel de Dream, it's my sense that many of the themes that have been in your books reemerge here. For one thing, Stephen Crane might as well be an intimation of someone dying of AIDS.
Well, TB was the 19th century version of AIDS.
Mm-hmm. And there he is, and he's being objectified by Henry James, and he's writing a novel about a boy prostitute that he's met once, that he's taken to dinner, and perhaps has been given a tour of Underlife New York, although the book is, I think, intentionally unclear whether this is an imagination, a dream, or an actual event. So that here we're watching Stephen Crane say, what if I were a boy prostitute? Just as Edmund White looks at Stephen Crane and says, what if Crane were a man wanting to write the first American gay novel? What language would he have to use? Where would he find it? How would he learn it? What kind of sentences? Would he feel obliged to tell us really that he's straight on every other page, the way novelists tended to do when they took on gay characters? And so I wanted to ask you, because this seems to me to be, I call them parables of art, you know, stories in which there are artists who meet and their ideas of what the reality of the world is are at the center. It's a kind of battle about reality. And in this case, Crane is trying to embody a world that he has been given access to. He's about to tell it on his deathbed. He's murmuring it to his wife in barely a whisper, the life of the secret gay underground of New York. And he does it knowing that these will be his last words. This will be his last testament. Tell me, you know.
Well, I think that this boy prostitute, Elliot, whom he's constantly meditating about and whom a kind of older married man falls in love with in a sort of totally hopeless and sudden and passionate way, I think that boy is Crane's muse. I mean, I think that, and I tried at the very last moments of Crane's life, he's imagining that he's seeing that boy flitting around. And it's not because he's attracted to him, because I think that's a real act of sympathy and imagination on Crane's part, because he is straight, to think out what that would be like to be attracted to a boy. But it's because the boy is himself. I mean, the boy is his own genius. And not that the boy is literary or himself a writer or even especially intelligent, but there's something about, maybe it's Plato's idea of beauty leading you to truth and concrete beauty leading you to the idea of beauty. But I think there's something Platonic, perhaps, in that meditation that Crane has on this boy.
I think also, as you say in your afterwards, this was at a time when homosexual men were groping to understand their own proclivities, let alone to have a language for it.
They had no theories of what, or they had so many different competing theories. I mean, sometimes they thought they were the third sex, and sometimes they thought they were androgynes. One of the characters in my book, who's based on a real person who wrote a book called Memoirs of an Androgyne, has himself castrated as a kind of early form of a sex change operation. I mean, a lot of people thought, well, if you're gay, or if you're homosexual, even that word wasn't determined yet. I mean, it existed already, but the usual word was invert, or pervert, or, you know, crazy person. I mean, there were all kinds of, but definitely there was this feeling of that there's something wrong with it. And yet, for the first time in centuries, I mean, in the pagan period, which lasted several thousand years, homosexuality flourished on an equal footing with heterosexuality. And it was only really Christianity that put the kibosh on all that. And Christianity's, the monotheistic religions are the great enemies of, well, I would say of civilization, but also, but certainly of homosexuality. I mean, those three monotheistic religions should go. But in any event, I think what happened was that by the end of the 19th century, there were the necessary conditions for homosexuality to reemerge, which was people can't come out unless they live far from their family, are independent financially, and are anonymous. And the big city suddenly provided that, those conditions, and it allowed men and women, because the first real lesbians who are visible are the ones of the 1880s and 90s. I'm not talking about aristocrats or writers. I'm talking about ordinary working women. That's when they begin to come out in a visible way. And so I think that that's why I was drawn to this period, the idea of New York in the 1890s, when everything is brewing, and yet people themselves, gay people, don't know what to think of themselves.
And the book goes up in smoke. It's Mrs. Crane, or the almost Mrs. Crane, Cora. They're not married, as Edmund mentioned, because they couldn't find her husband to get a divorce. By the way, this Hotel de Dream was the title of a beautiful and famous screenplay that was written to break a screenwriter who eventually wrote True Grit out of the blacklist. They told her that if you will write the best screenplay you can imagine, no one will be able to refuse to hire you. And she wrote about Stephen Crane and Cora, and the Hotel de Dream and the Cuban War, The Open Boat appears in the screenplay. Her husband was the novelist John Sanford, and he lent me the screenplay, and it was devastating. I mean, beautiful material. So when I came to this, I thought, wow, someone has done it. Someone has taken it on. But now the material is sent by Cora, who's received this dictation, and she asks Henry James to complete the novel of the boy prostitute, which they have called The Painted Boy. And what does James do?
Well, let me read the last page, if I might. This will run it for all of you. A month later, Cora was living in London, trying to find journalistic hackwork to pay her crushing bills. She'd arranged to have Stevie's body displayed in London in a glass coffin, and so on. By now, Cora had dictated the entire manuscript of The Painted Boy to an English woman who then typed it. They worked for 3 days, early to late, and the woman had demanded £3 for the endeavor, which was robbery, but necessary. In the margins, Cora had clearly indicated the changes and additions she thought Mr. James should make, and she'd of course flagged the unwritten scenes that Stephen had left blank for him to fill in. She was especially curious about how Mr. James thought that the book should end. Would Theodore live miserably ever after, divorced, embracing his burnt offering to the gods? She was proud of that poetic turn of phrase and thought it would tickle Mr. James. But that would mean abandoning Christine and so on, a bit about the plot. She sent the typed copy and the only version of the actual manuscript, all of Cora's handwritten dictation notes, to Mr. James. She imagined he would be moved by what were literally Stephen's dying words. Hadn't Mr. James been just the least bit sweet on Stevie? And in a postscriptum, she asked him if he could spare another £20. A week went by, anxious days. Then at her rooms in London, she received an envelope of the best vellum paper, creamy and all but coroneted. Dear Mrs. Crane, due to my own exigencies, considerable now that somehow, improbably, I've ended up with 3 servants attending on me, I've never been so much under the reign of the petticoat. I am disarmed financially and grieved to be unable to help you further. Nor am I able to receive you as a guest here at Lamb House, a genial idea you so gaily proposed, since my brother and his considerable brood are about to descend on me for a month. As for the curious little text you sent me, I was, of course, mesmerized by the bizarre fancies that belabored our Stevie's dying brain. Who would have thought that he, or anyone we know, could have developed such unwholesome thoughts? Truly malsain. And, to use my most condemning modifier, how straightforward he was in his procedure. Never fear, I have quietly committed this embarrassment to the fireplace here at Rye. Not a word remains. Naturally, you and I both wanted to silence even the slightest rumor that such a dank inspiration ever besmirched our Stevie's genius, characteristically so sunny and virile. Never fear, now his reputation is safe. We have protected it. Yours faithfully, Henry James.
You really hate these people in the closet, don't you?
Well, you know, James did had a gay cousin whose papers were entrusted to him, and he burned those. Of course, he was always burning everybody's letters. I mean, he burned all of his friends' letters, and he insisted they all burn his, but some of them didn't, thank God.
I thought that we would open it up to questions from the audience now, and there will be a microphone circulating among you, and please raise your hand.
To Mr. White, the Library Journal review of which I read on the catalog, they excerpted, criticized your, I guess, the Painted Boy portion, saying that your witty verbosity does not reflect Stephen Crane's spare style. Can you give an answer to that?
Well, I mean, I think I have 2 styles in the book, but I certainly didn't. I mean, of course, some very dedicated worshipers of the flame of above Crane's altar, especially heterosexual men of my age, let's say, hated my book because it does suggest that he might have been sympathetic to gays, and I mean, it had two or three really nasty sort of ad hominem attacks. But otherwise, I mean, most of the reviews have been quite positive. I never really imitated, I never set out to write a pastiche exactly of his style, which I don't think I'd be capable of. I tried to make sure that I used no word that would have been unavailable to him at that period. I tried to immerse myself in his writing as much as possible. But when people compare my Painted Boy unfavorably to Maggie Girl of the Streets, I think, when is the last time you read Maggie Girl of the Streets? It's one of the most appalling books ever written. I mean, he who went on to write a great book and wrote many great five or six great stories, Maggie Girl of the Streets is pure garbage. Although by the end it begins to be it gets to be kind of good, and you watch a very young writer learning how to write in the course of writing this 60-page novella. But most of it is just appalling, full of big words. It's not spare at all. It's very inflated and ridiculously inflated. So I think people who make these statements have a kind of vague memory of Red Badge of Courage, and maybe they wrote their senior thesis on it or something, and now they're 60, and, you know.
I think also that it's important to remember there was purity of style invented by Henry James, but realism, the purity of style of realism or naturalism, at least in American literature, it took nearly till Hemingway for you to be able to evaluate a sentence of fact and see if it was, you know, solid. So all of these books, when you read Frank Norris or you read Stephen Crane, or
Kreiser's
you read
Kreiser,
you keep finding these elevated passages that no realist, you'd never find them in Dennis Johnson or Hemingway. It took a long time for realism to refine itself in its own fire.
I think that's true.
I'd like to thank you for your social literary history tonight. But I am curious, how does one be a little bit gay? Is it like being a little bit pregnant?
I was just, I guess, being silly. But I think that, I actually believe in bisexuality. I mean, I think there are genuine bisexuals in the world. And I think there are a lot of people who have experimented with homosexuality who don't go on to pursue it, you know. I think that was more true before homosexuality was less visible. I think now that everything is gay, 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 and it's such an evident and obvious choice, it seems to be a lifestyle choice for people, that only those people who are extremely motivated would bother to jump over that very high threshold and go into this other world, which involves you in all kinds of things you might not like watching Will and Grace or something. And so there's this whole other culture, gay culture, that's highly developed, highly visible. People have to decide whether they really want to go to all that bother to join that. And I think that in the past, even in my remembered past in the 1950s, before when homosexuality was still the love that dare not speak its name, that there were an awful lot of men who experimented with it because there were no consequences and it didn't seem like a big deal. Even Kinsey's findings, I think, don't hold true anymore. I think Kinsey found many more. He thought 10% of the population had a significant period of their life as homosexuals. I would say 3% now. Because I think the result of gay liberation is that it's reduced the number of people who actually have gay sex. And when I spend time in countries like Morocco and where everybody's a lot more relaxed about these things, people say, oh, how can you have sex with people that you pay? Or how can you have sex with people who think they're straight? And I said, well, look, would you rather live in a culture where only 3% of the men are available to you? Or would you rather live in a country where 100% are available if you make the right maneuvers? But so a little bit gay, I think people can be a little bit gay. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks. I've got two questions, sir. One, did you say Albert Camus said American artists, writers are not intellectuals or are?
He said they're the only writers in the world who don't have to also be intellectuals.
Okay, good. The other thing is, I seem to read somewhere that Stephen Crane didn't wrote very little if in the last 2 years of his life when he was living with this with Cora.
Did no, he wrote a lot. He wrote a lot, but it isn't very good. Maybe that's what you're thinking of. He wrote a whole novel called Active Service, which I'll bet nobody in this room has ever heard of, except maybe you. He wrote another whole novel. He wrote another novel called The O'Ruddy, which was actually the book he was working on when he died, and that was completed for him by another writer, which is ghastly. He wrote lots of stories, two or three of which are very good. So, no, he did do a lot of writing because he had to keep this enormous establishment they were running going. He was paid more than any other living writer per line, and he would crank this stuff out, but most of it was dreadful.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC, 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. A loud theme composed by Larry Karish.